Hello, and welcome to another episode of Multifaithful. My name is Ari Lannis. I am with the Office of Global Spiritual Life at NYU. On this week's podcast, we are joined by Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, one of the most prominent Muslim American community leaders and the president of Zaytuna College out in California, as well as by Sana Mayat, one of our amazing students here at NYU. We are going to talk about similarities between Islam and some other religions, some of the challenges in talking about religion in really complicated contexts throughout the world, and also about religious education in the United States and different types of education systems we have here for educating people who want religious and secular educations together. Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful and another this week's conversation. I am joined today by Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, president of Zaytuna College out in the Bay Area. Sheikh Hamza, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm also joined by one of the most talented students we have at NYU, Sana Mayat. Sana, can you just introduce yourself quickly?
My name is Sana Mayat. I am a senior in the College of Arts and Science.
Great. So I have a feeling that most people who listen to the podcast don't know much about Zaytuna. I'd also imagine actually quite a few of them don't even know that there is a Muslim college in the United States. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the founding of Zaytuna, why you chose to start Zaytuna, and especially I've heard you on other occasions talk about your parents as incredibly invested in the liberal arts. And why you chose to start a Muslim liberal arts college as opposed to maybe studying Islamic studies at a secular university or doing something else. Like, why a Muslim liberal arts place to study?
Bismillah. The first thing, Zaytuna College was an idea, actually, that I started talking about in the 90s. That we needed institutions of higher learning. Every religious community that's come to the United States or to Europe from other places, I mean, Europe has only recently really come to accept other ways of viewing religion than, for instance, Catholicism, than Protestantism. And over the last few hundred years, it's become increasingly tolerant. So now you have a lot of religious institutions all over Europe and the United States, however, early on, that was one of the hallmarks, obviously the First mm-hmm. Amendment. And Washington wrote to a Jewish congregation that he did not want Jews to be anything other than actually part of America. So that's quite stunning, really, when you think about it at the time. And the Baptists, obviously the famous letter that Jefferson received from the Baptists, who were very concerned about a state religion, because a lot of these founding fathers were Anglicans, which they called it Episcopalians, which is the American version of Anglicanism. But there were some of the founding fathers were arguing for religious tests, and I think both of you probably know that Maryland was the Catholic state. In fact, the only Catholic that signed the Declaration of Independence was from Maryland and Maryland, the land of Mary. So early on, I think there was some pluralism. And what's interesting is that Jews and Muslims were actually mentioned in several early documents, that they did see that, because there were Muslims here in the early period. The first convert that we know in American history to Islam is somebody named George Bethune English, who was born in 1787. He was a graduate with distinction from Harvard University. He studied Arabic. Arabic was taught at Yale and Harvard 200 years ago. It was quite hard to believe, but they were doing that. So whenever any religious group has come here, they have invariably wanted to educate their children, particularly the Catholics, because they were very concerned about Protestant indoctrination, mm-hmm. because in the 19th century, most schools in the United States, despite the fact they were public schools, had Protestant teachers, and because that was the domination in the United States. And so they would obviously begin to proselytize their religion, and school prayer was completely accepted. Nobody ever had any arguments against school prayer until very recently. But what happens when the Irish had a huge immigration to this country in the 1840s because of the potato famine. They were very troubled about losing their Catholicism. Most of the Irish prior to that period were from Protestant Irish, what they call the mm-hmm. Anglo-Irish and the Ulster Plantation Irish. The first Irish president wasn't Kennedy, it was actually Andrew Jackson, but he was an Anglo-Irish. So they began to found Catholic schools, and those schools became some of the best schools in the United States, some mm-hmm. of the parochial schools. And they also founded preparatory schools. The actual preparatory school that I went to was founded in 1787 in Rockville, Maryland, by Catholics. So we have high schools that are a couple hundred years old that the Catholics mm-hmm. founded to preserve their religion. And so I think it's a natural part of the evolution of any religious community that's come to the United States to found a college. I'm giving you a kind of long-winded mm-hmm. historical narrative, but I think it's just part of the evolution. We have, believe it or not, several Buddhist colleges that are accredited in the mm-hmm. United States. We actually have Hindu colleges that are accredited. So the Muslims are late in the game, to be honest with you. So the fact that we're the first accredited college this late, given that so many Muslims came here mm-hmm. After 1965 with the Immigration Act that was passed under Johnson's administration. So I think it's a natural evolution for a religious community. The reason why liberal arts, and I'm going to talk about it tonight, liberal arts is really it's the foundation of Abrahamic education. So all of the Jewish education, the Christian education, the Muslim education historically was what we would today call liberal arts in its traditional definition, because it's now become a contested term, but mm-hmm. it wasn't originally. So
yeah, and I think Sana, when we were talking about preparing you, you mentioned your experience in public school as sort of a very different experience, like being Muslim in a public school, and I'm curious if maybe how the founding of Muslim schools and a Muslim school system, both a college and what would be
grade schools.
How is that going to change the experience of Muslim students in public schools? Or are we going to see, I imagine we will see fewer Muslim students or fewer percentage in public schools. Right. And what's that?
Do you want to address that?
I can only speak from the fact that I've gone to secular public school my entire life. And I'm a senior in college now.
Right.
And I've always felt like my identity as a Muslim student has been compartmentalized, where I'm only Muslim when I'm in the mosque or I'm in religious settings at the Islamic Center. But I never had that experience in the classroom where I didn't I had to make those connections on my own about what I'm learning in the classroom and how that impacts my faith or how I can bring that back into being a Muslim American or being a Muslim person in general. I've always wondered how do we merge the two without having religion built into the curriculum?
Right.
If I'm going to a secular school, how can I not box myself into certain spaces?
Sure. Well, I think the fact that you wear a hijab identifies yourself as a Muslim. So one of the tragedies of the post 9/11 experience for a lot of young Muslims is the bullying that's gone on. And that hasn't even been addressed. I've seen almost nothing about it. And yet the official numbers are over 50% of Muslim students in public schools have been bullied. And so we've got this supposedly society that's very concerned about bullying, and yet the Muslim bullying has not been any major issue. In fact, very few people even think about it. The idea of, hey, what's happening with all these Muslim kids
mm-hmm.
given all this anti-Muslim rhetoric? And these kids have really suffered, a lot of these kids in public schools. One of the things I think the Jewish community, especially the Muslim and the Jewish experience in diaspora, is very similar, because Muslims and Jews that practice their religion have certain dietary restrictions. I mean, certainly the Muslim restrictions are not as strict as a ultra-Orthodox or an Orthodox Jew, which very often prevents them from even participating
mm-hmm.
in food with others. But part of the reason for that was to preserve the integrity of their identity, their religious identity, because they were surrounded by atheists or polytheists or influences that that were harmful for them. And so a lot of the experience that the Jewish community has in trying to hold on to their religion and to their family values, because one of the major crises in the Jewish community in the United States is intermarriage, because the religion is tied to, there's a matrilineal bond in the religion. And so as Jewish men marry non-Jewish women, then the, and I know this because my sister married a Jewish man and converted to Judaism, so I, you know, in order for the children to be considered Jewish, so I know this firsthand. So I think for Muslims, this is a very similar problem that the Jewish community has already been through. And I think very similar things are going to happen that have happened in the Jewish community. So we have ultra-Orthodox Orthodox, we have conservative Jews, we have Reformed Jews, we have progressive Jews, we have now the LGBT wing of the Jewish religious community. And so even I learned in a dialogue once with a Jewish rabbi that you could be an atheist in certain strains of Judaism.
Sure.
Which really shocked, I mean, that just floored me. Because I said, well, we have an agreement on one God. And he said, I'm an atheist. And he was a rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what do you mean? Like, it was just such a pattern disruption for me. But anyway, my point being is that I think you're going to see the same iterations in
mm-hmm.
the Muslim community that you've seen in the Jewish community. Now, for those that really want to guard their religion, they will also go into those same patterns. So there are ones that will want the type of ultra-Orthodox Muslim
mm-hmm.
environment. And we have those in the Diobandi community, for instance. They really maintain their children. They most of them, many of the children memorize the Quran. They're in madrasa. And they don't have a lot of interaction with the mainstream society. There's going to be other examples where it's not that extreme. Our own methodology is not isolation, and it's not assimilation, but it's integration. So we're our model is that we want to be integrated in the society, but not assimilated into it. So we want to maintain our religious identity, our cultural values, which many are shared with quote-unquote traditional American cultural values. They're not that different to a lot of Christian values. In fact, there's an incredible amount of dovetailing and crossover
mm-hmm.
between the communities.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the comparisons to the Jewish community. So I grew up in an Orthodox home, and I went to Jewish day schools my entire
exactly.
life, kindergarten through
sure.
through 12th grade, and then a year in a seminary after, like, with further Judaic studies. But I was one of the few people from my high school class who didn't go to Yeshiva University for college, and I went to New York University, and this was actually a
huge... Were you in the Hasidim group?
No, a Modern Orthodox.
Okay.
I actually went to the high school that's at Yeshiva University's
okay.
campus, so that was part of even not going to Yeshiva.
It's a great
was,
university.
Right, and my brother's actually studies there now.
What about prize winners of Kamala?
Yeah, so, but it's interesting as you take a broad spectrum of the Jewish community,
mm-hmm.
which you were mentioning, different segments of the Jewish community approach the notion of, like, a Jewish schooling or the necessary, like, being in an exclusively Jewish school environment
mm-hmm.
versus being part of a public school
sure.
environment very differently.
Right.
And I'm curious, you're mentioning that you think the Muslim community might start to segment a little bit in this way. It's already segmenting.
Oh, yeah. And I think our prophet, peace be upon him, he said that you are most like the Jewish community and you will follow them handspan by handspan. So I think, and that's a sound hadith, you know. I think in some ways Islam, I mean, it doesn't have a lot of the idiosyncrasies that you'll find in real halakha law, but it's really a type of universalized Judaism in many ways.
Hmm.
So, and it retained a lot of the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we take ghusl, you have mikveh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so those aspects, there's a lot of similarities, and that's why it's sad that the communities are at loggerheads about a lot of things, and because historically there was a lot
yeah.
of shared tradition. And in fact, if you look at George Kohler's book, I mean, he's not really highly regarded in the Orthodox community, but George Kohler, who was the president of the Boston Theological Union,
mm-hmm.
wrote an interesting book about 100 years ago called Jewish Theology. And in there, he actually argues that that Islam is closer to Judaism, that both Christianity and Judaism and Islam were recognized by the medieval rabbinate as vehicles of the divine, mm-hmm. because they were preparing the world for the coming of the Messiah through the spreading of monotheism. But they said, but Muslims were full proselytizers, mm-hmm. and Christians were only half because of the confusion of the Trinity
right.
in the monotheistic tradition. So historically, even in traditional Jewish theology, it was much closer.
Mm-hmm. Sana, I'm curious, as you're hearing kind of these two different ways of kind of doing religious education, also secular education, as someone who's been through public schools and part of the NYU world, does it sound appealing? Like, does that appeal to you to think, like, oh, spending time in a Muslim environment like that? Like, can you think of how that may have influenced? Because I know that you're someone, and I know this because I get to work with you all the time, but you're involved in so many different areas of diversity conversations at a university, and that's something that really animates you in a lot of ways. So I'm curious how you would feel about balancing those.
I would love to be in, like, a place where we're like, actively talking about religion and things like that, like, with my, like, education, because I just feel like sometimes, especially at NYU, it feels like religion is, like stigmatized, where it's like you don't want to talk about religion, or if you're going to talk about it, you're not talking about it in a classroom,
right.
because
right.
it's like faith necessitates critical thinking necessitates proof, and that's like not something that can be reconciled with faith or things like that. And it's just like I feel like it's hard sometimes thinking about my faith, and like sometimes I take classes about Islam and it's taught by professors that aren't Muslim,
sure.
so we're critically analyzing certain
right.
things, and then it's like I'm balancing that with classes I take the Islamic Center and trying to understand like how
different.
I feel about
sure.
both and things like that. And I just like,
yeah.
it gets very confusing sometimes.
That's a good point. Jonathan Brown, he's a professor at Georgetown, he actually warns his Muslim students not to take his classes because he's using a secular methodology in his classes. One of the things that religious colleges offer students is that devotion is an acceptable expression. And, you know, I coined a term, it's a portmanteau word, but it never took off, which I called acadevotional, the idea
mm-hmm.
of having academic rigor, but also devotional commitment to your tradition. And in the mainstream academia, it's just not acceptable. I mean, I did religious studies at a secular university, and I did my doctoral studies at the Graduate Theological Union, which was different, because they honor religion but I used to get papers back too devotional, right? And that was the that was some of the remarks that I would get on papers, you know, that you have to be more critical of the faith. And I think for a lot of students at Zaytuna, that's one of the things that they talk about. It's finally they feel their face honored, they feel comfortable. But it's not like it's not a dogmatic approach to religion at all. One of the things that we argue there is that tradition, religious tradition, is inheriting a lawsuit, that you need to grapple with the tradition in each generation, that it's not something that you simply accept face value, because there are a lot of things that accrue over time in tradition that are actually negative. And what we're trying to do, and these terms aren't even acceptable in most modern humanities, but is trying to look at a transhistorical understanding of Islam. I mean, to give a secular example of that, if you look at the founding fathers, most of them were men in their times about slavery. That was just simply... And so for us, 200 years later, to project onto them our values and our sensibilities is, in a lot of ways, it's unjust, because most of the people doing that probably would have had those same views
mm-hmm.
at that time. But there are men like Benjamin Rush, who was a physician in Massachusetts, who was actually believed in the equality of races. He's a founding father. He's a signer on the Declaration. And he argued for full enfranchisement of slaves. He's a man for all time in that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things is determining, when you look at scholars, in what ways are they speaking for every time? Like Rumi is a very popular poet in the United States because he speaks across centuries.
Yeah.
He's speaking about the human condition. Aristotle, if you read the Nicomachean Ethics, many of the things that he's talking about, are they talk to us immediately. But then there are certain things that they're much more related to his time and place. And so trying to sift the wheat from the chaff, trying to
mm-hmm.
understand, you know, what is eternal? What are the eternal truths that are embedded in these religions? And then what are the temporalities? What are those things that have been handed on in tradition that really, they don't have anything to do with us or our time or our place? And that's a very tricky navigation
mm-hmm.
because you can end up projecting also a lot of the zeitgeist, which is what is popular in your time
yeah.
and place, that's not really transhistorical
right.
either, onto the past, which is very dangerous because then you lose the value of tradition.
Right. And I feel like also, I guess this was the theme of the podcast so far, but Judaism and Christianity share a similar struggle on this topic specifically because so much of the religious and liturgical cultural elements have to do with like a legal history.
Sure.
Hinduism
very much.
And so taking problematic elements of that history that may have a deep-rooted either like textual basis, like I know within the Jewish community, just having a lot of friends who are in the LGBT Jewish community, so I know a large part of the discussion is recognizing like how to balance the importance of certain ancient texts while also being comfortable saying that part of the moral tradition of that text is no longer relevant or no longer speaks to us, or how do we even frame that? And so I'm curious how that conversation plays out in the Muslim world or
on the LGBT issue?
Just in general.
In general. Well, I think one of the things my teacher, Sheikh Abdullah bin Bayya, talks about, he was asked recently about jihad, and he said, we believe in the what he called Qudsiyatun Nas, which means the sanctity of the revelation. So the text has a sanctity. The Quran, jihad is clearly a concept in the Quran. The Quran calls us to jihad. There are many verses about jihad. But what he said is, we do not believe in the sanctity of the application of the text.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where a lot of Muslims get very confused, that not all texts are to be interpreted the same way in every time and place. And this is something in Usul al-Fiqh, which is akin to constitutional law in America, like how we actually legislate. The Quran is much more a constitutional document than it is a statute document. There are actually very few statute laws in the Quran. Most of it is actually constitutional means and methods for generating law, which is why what's called the Muslims have always distinguished between Sharia and Fiqh. Sharia is sacred law, but Fiqh is human understanding of Sharia. And the vast majority of what we call Islamic law is Fiqh. It's not Sharia, which is why there are so many differences of opinions. They say if you have, and I know the Jewish community can appreciate this because they say the same thing about rabbis. If you have three imams, you have four opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of truth to that because many imams have two opinions about a subject. So you will literally find, in the books of fiqh, it'll say, fihi ta'wilan, there's two opinions about this from the same imam. And so that's just part of the vastness of the tradition.
So do you think that the complexity of how, because what you've just laid out for us is a incredibly complex and nuanced process for how anyone within the Muslim world would come to a conclusion about what they should believe
right.
on any issue. So
yeah.
How much of that complexity do you think plays into our modern discourse surrounding
None.
Islam?
None. That's why we're
None
in a
whatsoever.
Crisis. That's why we're in a crisis. Because the Islamic tradition, like the Jewish tradition, it takes years to master the tools to interpret the Talmud. You can't just open up the Mishnah and the Gemara if you haven't sat with rabbis and really gone through it. And it's a very rigorous training that you've had some experience in, so you know what it is. I mean, just the linguistic training, because so many nuances of every word, and why that conjunction, and why is this syntax phrased this way as opposed to this way. These are this is the gist of all Islamic tradition. I mean, we have countless commentaries on the Quran that just go into immense detail about all the possible interpretations of any text. And as long as you're working within the accepted tradition, so what we call usul al-fiqh, which is the methodology that you use for interpretation, it's our hermeneutic. As long as you're working within an accepted tradition, because there are different ways of interpreting, in the same way you have different ways of interpreting the Constitution in America. You have, you know, strict constructionists, you have loose, you have original intent, you have living constitutionalists. There's different ways that people look at the Constitution, and they're going to arrive at different. Also, you have positivists, and then you have natural law theorists. So somebody like Dr. Robert George at Princeton, who's one of the foremost constitutional theorists in America, he works within the natural law methodology of interpreting the Constitution. Bork was one of those people also before him. The people on the Supreme Court now, they're not working in that methodology at all.
Mm-hmm.
But all the founding fathers were natural law theorists. So those debates are always going to be around, and you're going to come up with a lot of different conclusions. Determining who has authority to speak on behalf of any religion
mm-hmm.
is problematic, especially in an age that we're living in, where you have almost antibodies to any idea of a hierarchical structure.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a type of neutrality that is demanded
mm-hmm.
of any group, because you have no right to speak authoritatively and to dismiss this other voice. So this is all a type of hegemony, or a hegemonic discourse based on heteronormativity and patriarchal approaches to the intersectionality of tradition and modernity and postmodernity. I mean, this is the way these people talk, and so they don't like anybody to speak with any authority. But when you have a religion as dangerous as Judaism, or as dangerous as Christianity, or as dangerous as Islam, and you leave these books that are incredibly problematic because of what is contained in them, you leave them to every Tom, Dick, and Abdullah to interpret, you're going to have the type of stuff that we're seeing, where people will kill abortion doctors because they believe that they're doing a great service to God, and like John Brown, that obedience to God supersedes obedience to the state. Or you're going to have people like Daesh, who claim, arrogate to themselves, the sole interpretation of Scripture, and argue that crucifixion, there it is, it's right in the Quran, therefore we're going to crucify people. Slavery, concubinage, it's in the Quran. Or you're going to have somebody like a rabbinical student go shoot Yitzhak Rabin because he feels that he's betrayed the Jewish people, and because of his treasonous action, he deserves to be assassinated by Talmudic law.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a serious problem, and I think people don't realize how deep and serious that problem is.
Right, and it feels to me that that you're far more open to recognizing and addressing that problem directly than most people within religious communities, because I know personally, I remember very well the day Rabin was assassinated.
Right.
I was pretty young, but I remember like my parents crying in front of the television.
Right.
I have like vivid memories of it, and I've talked to other members of the Jewish world who are really involved in interfaith activities, and many of them actually come back to Rabin as a moment of inspiration in the Rabin case. And I'm curious, have you encountered a lot of like people who who have like encountered this when it goes really wrong, and that's sort of their inspiration for trying to do the opposite. Like, is that something that you see a lot of? Because I know you do a lot of.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we're suffering on a larger scale. First of all, we far outnumber the Jewish community. So your extremists are always going to be far less in number than our extremists. But the Jewish community has their extremists. The Christian community has their extremists. And the Muslims have their extremists. Now, the dislodging of a lot of the Muslim states, the failed states that we're witnessing, the fact that there's a lot of post-colonial trauma in the Muslim world. In the same way, if you look at the African-American community, people are kind of like, get over it. Well, it's a little difficult to get over 500 years of slavery.
Yeah.
It's just not something that's going to happen overnight. And it's only since 1964 that there's actually been legislative change. And so, you know, this is like 50 years, and you're expecting 50 years to have overcome 500 years of injustice. It's not going to happen. There are certain black people in the United States that are thriving. That's true. But the vast majority in the inner cities, it's an incredible crisis. And the breakdown of the black church, which was one of the really strong elements that held the black community together. People talk about Black Lives Matter. I really would like to see a Black Families Matter movement, because I think the collapse of the black family is one of the major crises in the African American community. So the same is true in the Muslim world. You have a colonial trauma, and Muslims have not overcome that trauma by any stretch. And the Arab world in particular, because tyrants, I mean, there have been, unfortunately, unjust governments in the Muslim world for a very long time, despotic governments. But of late, because of the technology and because of the nature of the modern state, it's much worse than it's ever been. Despots never had the type of powers that they have today, even just for monitoring their citizens.
Yeah.
So those aspects have created a lot of trauma. Social media has introduced a type of genie that we can't get back into the bottle. So you would not have had the quote-unquote Arab Spring without social media. It just wouldn't have happened. And then television, 24-hour news cycles. People are traumatized. If you watch news, I'm amazed that kids aren't committing suicide at much higher rates, just because it's very depressing for kids out there. So, we have a lot of problems, and the Muslim community has witnessed a collapse of their intellectual tradition. And when you don't have a robust intellectual tradition to defend your religion, the defense of the religion usually becomes violent. And I think that's why you're seeing more violence. As the religion is assaulted, you're seeing more violence in the Muslim community as a reaction. But the truth is, and I would argue, that the actual numbers of violent Muslims are much lower than I would expect them to be, given the type of events that have happened. I mean, I actually think people don't realize how Islam is actually a constraining force. It's really containing the violence than unleashing it.
It strikes me as an opinion that might not get a lot of play in our current media cycles.
Yeah, because they're not looking at the realities. I mean, if you lost, the Iraqis have lost a million people. I'll give you an example. I'm always amazed. Like white supremacists, these kind of angry skinhead type people that hate black people. And I'm kind of like, who put you in chains and dragged you across the ocean? Like, why are you so angry at black people? I'm actually amazed at the goodness of most African Americans, the fact that they're not a lot more angry because of their historical experiences. And so I find the same is true for Muslims. I'm actually amazed at the Palestinian ability to meet Palestinians here in New York. You know, they don't spit at you or, right? I mean, it's pretty amazing. So I actually think that the Muslims generally, I think, are a very forgiving community, and I think that. I'm always overwhelmed by their generosity and their kindness. That's been my experience. Right? That's the really the the vast majority of my experience in the Muslim world was always like that. Even as an American, I never felt like because I was an American they would hate me. I think the anti-Jewish sentiment is very unfortunate, and I've tried to work towards, helping Muslims better understand the wrongness of a lot of the anti-Jewish sentiment, because you can be opposed to the state of Israel without hating Jewish people for being Jews.
Yeah. So I saw a lot of nodding in the last part, and I know we have to wrap up, so I'm curious if there's any specific part of that that you want to talk to, because I know that there are many issues that we just touched on that you work on campus all the time. So I'm curious what you think about some of these issues.
Yeah, I think it's like, you can't get away from people talking about Muslims right now. Like, I feel like you turn on the TV, you go on social media, anywhere, everyone's talking about Muslims in like horrible, horrible ways. We turned on the debate last night and there's like, just like really awful things being said about you and like people like you.
And just for the listener who, this is being recorded the night after the first presidential debate.
Right. And it's just like, even if people, I feel like I'm finding a lot amongst college students, it's like even people that didn't identify as Muslim before are like coming out more about it now, or being like, even like, I'm sensing even somewhat more empowerment in people where they're going out of their way to learn about what their Islam is or what it means to be Muslim more now, because
right.
everyone is talking about it.
Right.
Your identity is constantly attacked. Whether you
right.
identify that way or not, there's still people that are just like, like, I can say that about Muslims, you can't say that about Muslims, and I am Muslim, and I'm going to find out what that means to me. And I think it's very scary, so it's easy to like keep your head down and not pay attention to yourself or anything. But I do sense like more of like a fire like kindling underneath, like Muslims or people are just more outspoken about being Muslim or trying to figure out what that means to them, because it's being thrown in your face all
sure.
the time.
I think one of the problems that comes out of that is that identity politics becomes the dominant mode of expression. So Muslims begin to identify politically as Muslims as opposed to spiritually as Muslims. And that has a whole set of problems that accompany it.
Well, I could for sure continue having this conversation until the event tonight, but I think we're going to have to end here. Thank you so much
All
for
right.
your time, Sana. Thanks for hanging, as always.
All right. Sana. Thank you both.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. We especially like to thank our guests, Sana Mayat and Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, for joining us on the podcast and for such an insightful conversation. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Special thank you to Brian Young for editing and producing the podcast, as always. I look forward to having you back for another episode in 2 weeks.